We had all those things. And yet, the idea of marrying him filled you with dread. But I don't know why.
Because you want a creative life. One with freedom and space, and maybe a little passion, too. Simon's bound by tradition and convention. Even with all the money in the world, you wouldn't feel truly free with him.
But everyone needs some kind of anchor in their life, or else they drift.
Or alternatively, the anchor prevents us from moving forwards.
She eyes me cautiously.
What became of the wedding photographer?
I release a sigh. He wasn't who I thought he was.
I can tell from the pregnant pause that Aunt Jane wants to ask more, but she knows better than to probe too deep.
And Sebastian?
She beckons towards him up ahead, walking with Tom. I have a funny feeling he's into someone else, don't you? Aunt Jane flashes her big, playful eyes.
Talk about setting the cat among the pigeons.
I grimace. She's got some talking to do, that's for sure.
My advice to her would be the same as it is for you. When you follow your heart, all the rest has a strange way of following on behind.
Even though I don't fully believe it, I take some comfort from Aunt Jane's words of wisdom, and I can feel my head begin to clear, enabling me to focus on the buzz of discovering how much people love my work, and, more pressingly, on enjoying Jack's big night.
What are you guys talking about?
Asks Lizzie, who somehow managed to find us among the throngs heading towards the stage. She seems in much brighter spirits and immediately wraps herself around me, stumbling in the process.
The excitement of Beatrice making it as an up-and-coming designer, says Aunt Jane. Whimsy and white is perfect for you, says Lizzie, slurring slightly.
I figure she must have taken off earlier for a drink or two.
You've always been the one who was a little bit different.
She means it as a compliment, I'm sure, that I had the potential to do something unusual. But given my current anchorless state, it feels more like an insult. Hannah was always going to be a professional. Kat's always been happy so long as she's healthy, undefined by what she does. Lizzie was determined to be an art therapist. It was only ever me who didn't quite know where I belonged, either at work or in relationships. Being a jewelry designer felt more of a dream than something achievable. And I've always doubted myself. I guess it didn't help that all my mother really wanted was a husband and family. And look how that turned out.
How much have you had to drink?
I ask Lizzie, after she trips and I catch her just before she falls.
Nothing. I just went to see Jack. We needed to talk.
And you're sure you didn't have anything to drink while you were with him?
As if I would, she says, defensively.
What does that mean? Lizzie's always been so proud of how much she can drink, given she's so small. It's unlike her to be so hostile about it. Okay, I reply, not wanting to goad her any further in fear of spoiling the evening she's been looking forward to for so long. The three of us press through the gathering crowd, as close to the front as possible.
Isn't this brilliant?
Lizzie shouts as Jack and his mates run onto the stage, the crowd going wild.
It is,
I yell back. Remembering their first few gigs to an audience of 10 or 20 people to this, thousands of people all knowing their name and singing their songs. As the set progresses, I step to the side, away from the horde, watching my friends from a distance. Hannah has her arms draped over Remy, the two of them swaying in time to the music, lighters held aloft. Seb is singing along, lost in the lyrics, and then there's Aunt Jane and Tom. Their eyes brighter than any of those around them, even those who are a third of their age. Towards the end of the set, I catch sight of Lizzie, right at the front, screaming for Jack's attention, seemingly even drunker than before. When he eventually glances down, she lifts up her shirt, braless, and starts gyrating in front of him.
Jesus,
I mutter, when her image is blasted over the wide screens at the side of the stage.
Excuse me,
I start yelling, pushing my way towards her. It takes a while to reach her, but when I do, I pull her top back on and take her off to the side.
What the hell?
She says, angry at me for spoiling her fun.
You're making an idiot of yourself,
I say, holding onto her arm when she tries to break away.
No, I'm not.
Fine, You're not, but you are making a fool of Jack. Now come on. I'm taking you back to the tent.
Lighten up, Bee. Try having a little fun for once, she yells,
this time getting away from me and running towards the trailer park.
Shit, I say,
watching her run as the heavens open and the rain soaks us all.
Why would Lizzie behave like that?
Asks Remy, back at the tent, our wet clothes hanging round the stove. Because she's clearly drunk her way through almost an entire brewery. I sit cross-legged on my bed, my hands wrapped round a mug of hot chocolate, which Aunt Jane has made to repair my emotional wound.
But why? It's so unlike her.
She has been kind of weird recently, says Hannah, reclining next to Remy on their bed. I'm guessing things aren't resolved between her and Jack over the tour.
Where is she now?
Asks Aunt Jane. She went off in the direction of the trailers. She must be with Jack.
Do you think he'll go to America?
Asks Hannah.
I don't see how he can't. You saw how the crowd reacted to them tonight. They're big news. Why would he opt out of that?
Because he promised his wife he'd stay home.
I can't figure out why Lizzie's so adamant about him being here, I say. They know they can make long-distance work. They've done it before.
Maybe it's more about the kid thing, says Hannah. You know she's always been crazy about having a family. Lizzie's maternal instinct is pretty strong. I think she's genuinely keen to make it happen sooner rather than later.
Well, the drinking won't help,
says Hannah, ever the pragmatist.
Now, children, says Aunt Jane, resplendent in a pair of silk pajamas, her hair in a plait, rubbing face cream into her cheeks. Perhaps we should hear it from the woman herself.
Hear, hear, mumbles Tom, sleepily, already tucked under his duvet for the night.
I'm just about to snuggle down myself when Cat returns, an almost empty bottle of wine in hand.
Hey, I say. What happened?
It's over. I called off the wedding. Her news is met with a chorus of groggy affection and hugs, which she soaks up limply, before sitting on the corner of Sebastian's bed. I know she's hurting, and it's not the right time to say it, but I do feel she's made the right decision.
And where's Henry? Asks Aunt Jane, climbing into bed.
Gone.
What can we do to help?
Asks Hannah. Nothing much. I'll be fine.
Let's call it a night, shall we?
Suggests Tom, kindly.
I agree, says Aunt Jane, turning out the retro-style bedside camping lamp. Everything will be clearer in the morning.
I might sit up a little longer, just in case Lizzie comes back, I say.
I'll join you, says Cat.
Sebastian pats the duvet beside him to indicate that Cat is welcome to make herself more comfortable. We chat for a while about what transpired between her and Henry. She'd been leaning towards forgiving his one-night stand, but his apoplectic reaction to her kissing Sebastian honed her sight, and she knew she had to call the wedding off. But it's quite tricky to talk while the others are trying to sleep, so in the end, I resort to reading, while Kat and Sebastian whisper quietly in the dim light of the tent. I'm beginning to drift into sleep when the sound of someone staggering into the tent jolts me awake.
Lizzie?
I ask.
What's going on?
Asks Kat, who's still sitting up with Sebastian.
Hey, guys, slurs Lizzie. Took me forever to find you. I've been into every fucking tent on the avenue.
Bloody hell, Liz, says Kat, getting off the bed.
Why didn't you call?
Lost my phone, she says,
with an exaggerated shrug, swaying ominously. Is everything okay? I ask, fetching her some water.
Never better.
Water dribbles down her chin.
Jack's going on tour and I'm staying at home. Simple.
She stumbles towards my bed, then falls face first onto it before passing out. Well, at least we know why she's been so weird, says Kat, both of us staring at Lizzie.
Although there is still one problem.
What's that?
I point to where Lizzie is on the bed.
That's where you were meant to be sleeping.
Don't worry, says Sebastian. Cat can sleep next to me. Cat shrugs an okay. Are you sure? I ask, concerned she might not be thinking straight after calling off the wedding.
I'm sure.
She reaches over to give my arm a reassuring rub, her eyes glinting in the dark. Chapter 22. I wake to the sound of Aunt Jane stirring porridge on the stove, the morning light filling the tent with a mellow glow. Tom is up and dressed, reading a paper, while Kat, Sebastian and Lizzie are all still dead to the world.
Where are Hannah and Remy?
I ask, sitting up and rubbing my eyes, noticing their empty bed.
Hannah's gone for a run, and Remy is holding an impromptu yoga class outside, says Tom, accepting a bowl of porridge from his wife.
Bit too eager, if you ask me, says Aunt Jane. I'm certainly not doing one of those rhinoceros positions, or whatever you call them, until I've had my breakfast.
Agreed,
I say, stretching myself awake.
What happened here?
She asks, beckoning towards Kat and Sebastian.
Lizzie passed out next to me.
We both look at Lizzie, breathing fumes, her face squashed against the pillow.
So Kat had to bunk in with Seb?
Had to? She inquires, bringing me some porridge.
I think it's fair to say it softened the blow of ending things with Henry.
I fell asleep listening to sounds of them fooling around underneath the blankets.
You don't mind?
Not at all. I'm not interested in Sebastian in that way, and besides, I reckon it's just a rebound thing for Kat. Just then, Kat's phone pings, causing her to stir, her hand fumbling on the floor for it.
Oh, shit,
she mumbles, reading the text, still half asleep.
Everything okay?
I ask. Sitting up, her hair a fantastic mess, she tries to focus on the screen.
Henry wants to talk.
Kat looks to Sebastian, still fast asleep.
Did you?
I whisper, my eyes lowered toward Sebastian's nether regions. She nods sheepishly, flushed with embarrassment.
Wow! This should really give Henry something to think about.
Maybe, she says, biting her bottom lip. I hope she's not thinking of changing her mind.
What's going on?
Asks Lizzie, prizing her cheek from the pillow where she's lain motionless since she fell face first into it. Kat called off the wedding, but Henry wants to talk things through, I tell her, quietly so as not to hurt her head any more than it already appears to be hurting. Her eyes are narrowed and bloodshot.
Tell him to fuck off,
she mutters, putting her head back onto the pillow.
You're better off without him. We're all better off without men. Hannah's the only sane one among us.
Speak for yourself,
says Aunt Jane, swinging Tom's hand. Things aren't that bad, are they? I ask, offering her a bottle of water.
Jack has to tour or else he loses his place in the band. I'd say it's pretty bad. We had a big fight.
I stroke her hair. Sounds like he's stuck between a rock and a hard place. She lets out a little grunt of grudging acceptance. Remember your vows? To move forward, ready to risk, dream, and dare. Maybe this is one of those moments where you have to risk letting him go for a bit. Dare to be brave, to let him dream. You know he'd do the same for you. Lizzie puts the pillow over her head to block my voice out, but then she reaches out her hand.
Sorry I was mean to you last night.
Forgiven, I say, squeezing her hand, thankful that I'm single and not having to run the gauntlet of emotions a relationship can bring. I'm trying to coax water into Lizzie when Hannah returns from her run.
I don't think you'll believe who I've just seen,
she says, reminiscent of Martin, the hapless bookshop assistant in Notting Hill.
Who?
Asks Lizzie, managing to sit up enough for a bit of potential showbiz gossip.
Was it someone famous?
Lizzie loves a celeb. Hannah stretches out her calf muscles.
Nope. That would have been a bit of excitement,
says Tom. I can't tell if he's being sarcastic or not.
I once saw Paul McCartney,
says Lizzie.
Where?
I ask, surprised I haven't heard this story before.
In Regent's Park.
Kat and I exchange skeptical looks.
least I think it was him, though it might have been that Den Watts from EastEnders.
You mean Leslie Grantham?
I've no idea if Lizzie is deliberately rewriting the scene or if she's just seen it so often that it feels like something she'd say anyway.
Why, that guy.
Liz, Leslie Grantham and Paul McCartney look nothing alike, says Kat, playing along with a laugh.
He was quite far away.
So what you're saying is it might not have been either?
Guess not.
Not a classic anecdote, Liz, says Hannah, throwing a sweaty, balled-up running sock at her.
So who did you see, smartass?
Says Lizzie, lobbing the sock back at Hannah.
Leo. For a moment, no one says anything, everyone discreetly looking in my direction to see what my reaction might be.
What's he doing here? I ask, trying for cavalier, but not pulling it off.
Working, I guess, she says, rubbing her face with a towel.
Did you stop to talk to him?
Sure.
What did he say?
Not much. Something about a photoshoot opportunity that delayed his trip back home.
Suddenly my chest feels tight and my mind is turning over a thousand thoughts.
He said he'd try and find the tent later. Stop in and say hello.
My heart skips a beat. So he could arrive now with me in my knackered pajamas and bird's nest hair. Though why I should care so much, I've really no idea. Fuck, I mutter, grabbing a towel, change of clothes and loo bag and running for the shower block. A half hour later, washed, dressed, and with a skim of makeup on, but not so much that looks as if I'd give a damn, I mosey out of the shower block feeling ready to face Leo head-on and confront him about his behaviour at the club. That is, until I see him lazing on the grass opposite, seemingly without a care in the world, and at that point my stomach flips like a pancake. Shit, he's hot, I think, my amygdala getting the better of me. Get it together, B. Hot or not, the guy has issues. Hi, I say, curtly, making it clear from the start that he's not in my good books. Hey, he says, getting up and nervously wiping his hands on his jeans. He leans in to kiss me on the cheek, but I swerve, and he ends up kissing my ear. I stop by the tent, he says, tentatively, sensing my mood. Your aunt says I might find you here. Well, here I am, I say, flatly. I've no intention of making this easy for him, even if everything about him does make me quiver. He shifts awkwardly for a moment, shoving his hands into the pockets of his jeans, his shoulders raised.
Would you like to grab some brunch? There is a churro stand just over there.
He indicates to a converted old van. Sure, I say, shrugging my shoulders as if I'm not that fussed, though quietly I'm pleased by the offer, never being one to turn down sweet carbs. On the way to the stall, I relent to some polite chit-chat about the festival, the atmosphere, the bands, but still making it perfectly clear from my tone that I'm anything but pleased about him kissing me when he was with Britt. Once we've grabbed our churros, Leo's with coffee and mine with hot chocolate, we take a seat at the colourful, if rickety, wooden tables and chairs beside the van. So how come you delayed going back home? I ask, wondering if something has changed between him and Britt.
I got a shoot for a big magazine, a backstage piece of the summer festivals.
Congratulations, I say, unable to conceal my happiness for him. Will you head home after it's done?
He nods. The wedding season is almost over. Katz was the last in the diary, and I got a message late last night to say that's been cancelled.
Right. I can't pretend to be overly disappointed, I say, hoping not to come over too harsh.
No?
Henry was cheating on her, I explain, feeling a little of my hostility towards him waning. And, if I'm honest, they never seem like a good fit. I don't know how it went on as long as it did.
It's not always easy to know the ins and outs of other people's relationships.
There's something in his tone that makes me think he's had some experience of this, causing me to wonder what he's not saying. We sit quietly for a moment, both of us drinking, watching passers-by milling around, perusing the stalls.
How's the jewelry going?
He asks,
after a time. I tell him about Hilary Bentham and Whimsy and White.
Congratulations, Bee!
His eyes brim with admiration, and before I know it, he's reached over to hug me, and a tingle of desire rushes through my body. I hold the embrace longer than I should, and he does too. We pull apart to explore each other's eyes, trying to read the other's mind and wondering if we're both feeling the same thing. We should consider Brit, I say, breaking away when it becomes obvious we're about to kiss again. I want to shake myself. This is exactly the kind of behavior I've always hated, the kind of thing my father would have done. So why am I still interested in this man?
You're right, we should, he says, pulling away, and there's a slightly awkward pause. I'm sorry if my behavior's been a bit erratic. I shirk the comment away. It hasn't really shown you in your best light. I can imagine.
What's going on? You don't really seem sold on your decision to settle back home with Brit. He indicates to the vendor that he'd like a refill, then takes a second to gather his thoughts.
It's a long story, but I'd like you to hear it, he says, an earnestness in his eye. It's important to me that you should understand why I've behaved so badly.
Then go ahead.
Do you remember the family photo I showed you?
Sure, I say, recalling the picture of him with the beach in the background.
And you remember you asked about the other family?
Uh-huh.
Brit is part of that family. We've known each other since we were kids. When Dad left us, Brit's dad stepped up and filled the gap he left.
He sounds like a good guy, but I'm still none the wiser.
When we were about 18, we began dating, and not long after, I started doing my first photography gigs. Brit would help me out. It was a bit of a slog at times, long hours, long drives, but it made us pretty tight. Then, after a few years, I decided I wanted to go traveling. Brit wanted to stay home with her family. We just began to drift apart, and eventually we broke up.
I nod along, following the story, wondering where it's going.
Fast forward 3 years, and I get a call to say that her parents have been involved in a road accident, so I rushed home to be with them. When I saw her dad in the hospital, he asked me to promise that I'd always take care of her, to help in any way I could. In the end, both her parents passed away. Brit's brother was 16 at the time. She had to look after him. And to do that, she needed money, so I offered for her to work as my assistant again. Since that time, we've been on and off.
You were right when you said it was complicated, I say, sympathetically.
Right,
he says, with a dismal laugh.
And what makes it more complicated is that Brit now wants to start a family.
Wow, I let out a whistle. How does that fit in with being a photojournalist?
It doesn't, really. But until this summer, I was prepared to give up on that dream so that she might have hers. Given she helped me get mine kick-started, I figured I should do the same for her.
What happened this summer? I ask, my upset over him kissing me beginning to dissipate.
Lizzie's wedding? And the thunderbolt that was you?
He pauses, drinking me in as if I was something completely unobtainable.
I knew exactly what I wanted, but wasn't able to have it.
Once in a blue moon, I begin, remembering what he said to me on Parliament Hill.
Someone comes along who trips you up. Someone who makes it crystal clear where you're meant to go next.
I thought that was just a line to get me into bed, I say, relieved to learn that my instincts were right, that he isn't the self-centered womanizing arse I made him out to be in my head. No, never, he says, his eyes full of sincerity.
But Brit and her family have been there for me since my father left. She helped me get started in photography. I owe her and them so much. The last few years have been the worst years of their lives, and she, in particular, has needed me.
But her brother is an adult now. She's no longer his carer.
He is,
and gradually they're all moving on, but I don't see how I can just drop her like a stone just because I found someone I'm more passionate about.
You refuse to be the person who gives up on someone, I say, remembering what he told me the morning after we slept together. And suddenly it all makes sense. Those things that I thought he lacked, loyalty, a sense of integrity, are actually the things at his core, but they're also the root of our struggles. I promise her father, you know? And I refuse to be like my own father. I refuse to go back on a promise.
But you promised him you'd care for her, not marry her, I say, hoping my support doesn't come over as self-interest, hoping he knows how much it means to me that he is nothing like his dad or mine.
Just because you fall for someone else doesn't mean you can't be a good friend to her.
He looks at me as if he's in a dream. You're so sweet, Bea. So understanding and considerate. Not to mention sexy. I laugh off his adulation. And what about Britt? She sounds like she's all of those things too.
She is, he says, his brow furrowed in thought. But lots of people have those qualities, don't they? Ultimately, if there isn't the spark, the passion, then what is there?
I can't answer that, I'm afraid.
Only you can.
There's a moment of quiet between us that's broken by the call of my name. I turn to find Remy running towards us.
Bea,
she says, breathless, clutching her side.
You have to come. Quick. Lizzie is sick.
What do you mean? I ask, assuming it's alcohol-induced.
She's unconscious,
she says, reaching out her hand.
Come on!
Chapter 23 Remy grabs my hand and runs, leading me through the dawdling festival-goers, the stalls, the tents, and past the stages. By the time we get to Lizzie, an ambulance is already there with paramedics working on her. Jack is stroking her hair. Hannah and Kat are by her side, and the rest of the gang are standing around, hands on faces and each other, staring blindly at her body.
What happened? I ask, barely able to breathe at the sight of her lying motionless on the ground.
Aunt Jane wraps an arm around me.
We think someone spiked her drink last night, says Kat, looking up from where she is beside her. It's only caught up with her now.
God. That explains why she was so adamant about not drinking.
Who would do that?
We don't know. All we know is that she's unconscious and showing no sign of coming round. My heart freezes as I look at Lizzie's limp body. Beautiful, irreverent, joyous Lizzie. I can't bear to think about what might happen, or about the fact that I've been with Leo while she's been lying here. They need to get her to hospital, says Kat. As Lizzie is wrapped in a red blanket, which Jack tenderly tucks around her. I watch as the paramedics ask everyone to stand back, and they transfer Lizzie from the cold, muddy ground to a trolley. Jack wears the look of a man who's just had his entire world blown apart. Then, as Lizzie's about to be taken to the ambulance, I can hear a choppy sound in the distance.
That's the air crew now, says one of the paramedics.
Air crew? I utter.
They'll take her on the helicopter to Bristol. It's quicker that way.
I know nothing about medicine, but even I know that when someone needs an air ambulance, it's not good. It doesn't take long for the ambulance to land, and the doctor, in bright orange overalls, to reach Lizzie. After gathering information from the paramedics, he crouches down beside her.
Lizzie, he calls, opening her eyes and flashing a torch into them. Lizzie, can you hear me?
Come on, Lizzie. Say something.
Let's get her on the aircraft, he says. We need to get her scanned. ASAP.
Scanned? Scanned for what?
Before I have the chance to question what's going on, the doctor asks,
Does anyone have a medical history for this woman? Medication, allergies, implants?
My mind goes blank.
Come on, Bea, think. You lived with her for years. You must know if she takes any medicine.
She's asthmatic, says Hannah.
And allergic to codeine, says Kat.
Any metal implants?
No, says Hannah.
And could she be pregnant?
They both shake their heads.
Actually, says Jack, stepping forward, all of us listening to what he's about to say. She's 11 weeks.
Thanks, says the doctor, ushering Jack forwards. Come on, let's get going.
I watch Lizzie being taken to the helicopter, Jack by her side, and ask myself, how could I not have known? How is it possible that I didn't notice that one of my best friends was 11 weeks pregnant? As she's loaded into the back of the chopper, I run through the last few months in my mind, and suddenly it becomes clear. Not only her hesitancy about Jack leaving for his tour, but the little things too. Not drinking or dancing at Mahiki's. A sense that Jack didn't know what side his bread was buttered. No G&T during Truth or Dare. All the clues were there. I've just been too self-absorbed to notice. We all head back to the tent. Me flanked by Hannah and Kat, the others following on behind.
I'll make hot chocolate, it'll help with the shock, says Aunt Jane when we arrive back.
The memories of the four of us drinking hot chocolate after school at Aunt Jane's house make me burst into tears. How petty all our teenage angst seems now.
She's in safe hands, says Kat,
sitting next to me on the bed, gently rubbing my back.
But she looks so lifeless.
I can barely believe the words I'm saying.
Her body was in shock. Sometimes bodies look like they've shut down, but really they're busy repairing themselves. Give her time.
I can't get my head round who would do such a thing, says Hannah.
She and Remy are huddled on their bed, a blanket over their shoulders like survivors of a shipwreck.
Maybe it was a prank gone wrong.
Poor girl, says Tom,
his eyes hazy with moisture. It's the first thing he said since she left.
But she's strong, says Remy.
If anyone can get through this, it's Lizzie.
You're absolutely right, says Aunt Jane. It's important to remain positive for her.
And the baby, I say, causing everyone to fall silent. The magnitude of the news too great to make sense of.
Did anyone know?
Asks Sebastian, hugging a pillow.
I had no idea, I say, accepting a hot chocolate from Aunt Jane.
But if she's 11 weeks, then it must be a honeymoon baby.
It certainly clears up why she's been so keen for Jack not to go on tour, says Kat.
I blow on my hot chocolate, lost in my thoughts.
We should decide who's doing what, make a plan. Somebody needs to be with her, says Aunt Jane.
It doesn't make sense for all of us to go to the hospital. Jack is with her, and her parents will be there within an hour or so, I say.
I have a deposition in the morning, says Hannah, her voice heavy with regret. I really have to get back to the city.
I'll drive, says Remy.
And I can take Jane and Tom home, says Sebastian.
Thank you, says Aunt Jane, already packing her bag.
That's kind, says Kat,
getting up to go over and kiss him on the cheek.
It is not a problem,
he says, giving her a warm hug. They look so good together, snuggled up close, but despite their dalliance, my hunch is that Kat's heart is with Henry. In spite of our best intentions to remain positive, the mood is still pretty solemn by the time we've packed our backpacks ready to leave. The excitement of yesterday seems like a lifetime ago, and the fun of the festival, still going on around us, feels remote, as if there's a force field between it and the seven of us.
Knock, knock, says a voice from the entrance to the tent, breaking the heavy silence in which we've all been packing.
Hi, Leo,
says Kat, putting on her backpack and securing its waistband with a click.
Hey, he says, his voice quiet, sensitive to the mood.
Come in.
It's obvious to everyone that Leah's here to see me, so with their bags packed, they begin to filter out.
You let me know if you need anything at all,
says Aunt Jane, with a kind wink and a stoic rub on the arm. Tom hugs me gently. I bite hard on my lip. It's all I can do to stop myself from brimming up again.
I'll take care of them,
says Sebastian, kissing my forehead and following them out.
And I'll wait a few tents down, says Kat out of earshot of Leo. Take your time.
You have great friends,
says Leo, once everyone's away and the two of us are alone in the tent, which without the others just feels large and cold.
I really do.
My voice breaks and tears flow freely down my cheeks.
Sorry,
I say, laughing at my own fragility, clumsily wiping my eyes.
Don't apologize.
He puts his hands on my arms and squats a little to bring his eyes level with mine, brushing away a hair that's stuck to my damp cheek.
You've had a terrible shock.
I nod, inhaling sharply, trying to gather myself as Aunt Jane would have me do. Leo's eyes are still level with mine, and as I attempt to pull myself together, I see a look of desire grow in them. An affectionate, sincere look that says he wants to kiss me. And in that moment, feeling lost and afraid, I almost let him.
What about Britt?
I ask gently, not wanting to create conflict. He sighs, sounding weary.
Britt and I need to talk.
Yes, you do, I say, stepping back. And if you choose to help her fulfill her dream, then I'll accept that decision, with no regrets.
He laughs wryly. At least one of us would be free of regret.
I take his hand in mine, and looking deep into his eyes, I offer him the words Aunt Jane gave to me. Follow your heart, and the rest will follow.
I just need to figure out exactly what my heart is telling me, he says.
Only you can do that.
Yes, he says, looking at me longingly.
And if it makes you feel better, I'm not interested in anyone else. Once Lizzie is better, I plan to focus on me for a while, call Hilary Bentham, eventually hand in my notice, make a name for myself.
You're following your heart.
For once, I am.
I'll try and do the same, he says, his watch buzzing a reminder.
Shit, is that the time?
I have to go.
Of course, I say, for once feeling that I'm the one in control of this relationship. I can see from Leo's rapid eye movement that his mind is working overtime, that he's agitated at having to rush our goodbye.
Goodbye, Bea.
His voice is strained. We both know that after today, that's it. He flies back to California. More than likely, we'll never see each other again. Take care of yourself, I say, my thoughts turning to Lizzie, wanting desperately to be with her. Chapter 24. Cat's ancient Land Rover Defender, just like Tom's in Four Weddings, is noisy and uncomfortable. But she's had it for such a long time, and we've shared so many memories in it that it's almost like a piece of home. We're bombing down the motorway towards the hospital. Do you remember when we almost careered into the sea at Cromer when the handbrake failed? I ask, my knees tight against the green metal dashboard.
Don't remind me.
And the time the four of us all had to sleep in it when we ran out of petrol.
We were like sardines in a tin.
And Lizzie spent the night convinced that someone was going to slaughter us in our sleep because the doors wouldn't lock.
Lizzie's imagination always has got the better of her, says Kat. Remember when we hid Hannah in that cupboard at Aunt Jane's and told Liz it was haunted? And every time Lizzie asked it a question, Hannah would push one of the top drawers open as if the ghost was communicating with her.
God, that was funny. We were cruel to her sometimes.
Only ever with affection.
Life wouldn't be the same without her, I say, swallowing back a huge lump in my throat. Kat glances over to me, reaching out a hand.
She'll be okay, Bea.
Yes, I say, determined to remain positive. I'm sure you're right. It's just...
What?
I can't help thinking. All this Four Weddings business. I hate to be the one to say it, but there was also a...
Don't even go there, says Kat, staring, unblinking, ahead.
No. You're right. Of course she'll be fine. I shake away the thought. And the baby too.
They'll both be fine.
It's clear from Kat's slightly aggressive, positive stance that she's as frightened as I am. Can you imagine Lizzie as a mother? I say, trying to lighten the mood. She'd probably keep misplacing the baby. Kat laughs. She doesn't know it, but I see her hurriedly wipe away a tear.
She'd leave it in the supermarket trolley or at the side of the road,
or by a park bench.
Oh, geez, it has disaster written all over it.
I laugh at the endless baby-related catastrophes Lizzie could be capable of. But the truth is, she'd be the most doting, loving mother a child could ever wish for. You're right, I say, my mind drifting to the thought of her on a hospital bed, fighting for both their lives. Fill me in on what happened with Leo, says Kat, sensing my darkening thoughts and trying to take my mind off them. I explain about how things stand with Britt. He needs to figure out what he wants. I can't do that for him.
And what about you? Are you getting any closer to what you want?
Do you know, I think I am, I say, breaking open a packet of licorice all sorts, which we picked up at the petrol station to keep ourselves going. Once we know how things stand with Lizzie, I'm going to work my ass off to get my collection complete. If Whimsy and White are interested, then that's brilliant, and if not, I'll do it alone.
Good for you, Bee.
She pops a Bertie Bassett into her mouth.
So, Leo's forgotten?
A flight of fancy, I say, sounding completely over him, even though a little pang in my heart hopes he'll choose me over Britt.
And Simon?
What about him?
She grips the steering wheel a little tighter.
If I'm completely honest, Bee, I never really understood why you broke up with him.
The spark had gone.
Though he was completely stable. If my father taught me anything, it's that stable matters.
Kat considers this for a moment.
You've mentioned that before.
It's kind of important, don't you think? It looked to me as if you and Seb might have it.
She drums her fingers on the wheel.
Henry really wishes I hadn't called off the wedding.
Do you want it back on?
I'm not sure. I don't want to be with him. I don't want to be without him.
Do you want to know what I think? She laughs. I'm not sure about that either.
I think you should tell him to wait and explore things with Sebastian a bit more. If that doesn't work out and it's meant to be with Henry, then it will happen. Sleeping with Sebastian was just a tit for tat. I really should tell Henry.
I think that's a bad idea.
I have to. I feel so bad about what I did.
Really? I ask, surprised. It's not as if you and Henry were together. And you fancied Seb since Hannah's wedding. You have loads in common and, dare I say it, he's far kinder than Henry. Remember that halfway house we talked about?
She nods, her mouth tight in thought.
Maybe Sebastian is that, I say. I don't think so. I think he's more into me than I'm into him, and besides, there's too much unresolved with Henry. We've both made a mistake. I owe him more time.
Kat, you know I don't believe in the one, but surely if what's happened to Lizzie shows us anything, it's that there is something close to the perfect match. We rib Lizzie and Jack relentlessly for being so loved up, but maybe if we can't be like them, we should just let it go.
You sound a lot like Charles after Gareth's funeral.
I laugh. She's right, I do.
But like Tom, I never really expected a thunderbolt, says Kat. I've always leant more towards meeting a guy I like the look of and making a go of things. My parents don't have a really romantic relationship and it works for them.
What do I know? I say, giving up. It's not that I want Henry to be romantic. I just want him to be less of a shit. Given I'm the only one of us not even close to marriage, you're probably better without my advice. Maybe Charles was right in the first instance. Maybe this waiting around for one true love stuff gets you nowhere.
Does that mean you'd marry Simon?
I look at her as if she's gone mad.
Simon is with Edith.
And if he wasn't?
I have absolutely no idea. Though right at this moment, with Lizzie being as she is, I'd give anything for the warmth and security of his arms. The drive took less than an hour, but it feels like an eternity. Knowing I can wait no longer, Kat drops me at the entrance of the A&E before going to look for a parking place.
I'll be in as soon as I can,
she calls, and I slam the car door, running inside as fast as my legs will carry me. "Where can I find Lizzie Strachan?" I ask at the reception desk. The woman, in an uncomfortably tight blue uniform, punches her name into the computer.
"She's still with us?" she says.
I know she means she's still here in A&E, but for one heart-stopping moment it sounded as if she was saying she hasn't died yet. "Can I see her?"
"You are?"
"Her sister," I lie, vindicated by the fact that though we may not be biologically related, we're as good as the real thing. She eyes me warily, but then sees the desperate look in my eye.
"Let me get someone to take you through."
I pace the waiting area until a nurse appears and escorts me into the part of A&E you never want to see. The part where people are having their hearts restarted and major blood loss stemmed. Whatever I was expecting to see when I arrived, I wasn't prepared for this. Lizzie is lying on a bed in the middle of a curtained area, surrounded by medics, machines, and tubes. She looks unrecognizable. The only thing that's familiar is the little butterfly tattoo on her ankle that she forced me to have done with her when we were 16. Jack comes over to be with me. "How is she?" I ask, putting my arm around him.
"It's a bit early to say,"
he says, his voice frail.
"She's just had a scan. We'll know more soon, but for now, the doctors say it's touch and go."
I stare at the butterfly on Lizzie's ankle, and for the first time in a long time, I pray. Chapter 25. I wake in the morning to a message beeping on my phone.
"Is it Jack?" asks Kat, sitting up.
"It's Simon," I say, barely awake. "He's heard about Lizzie. He's asking if there's anything he can do."
"That's sweet of him."
Kat rolls her neck and shoulders with a satisfying crack.
"Isn't it?" I say, wishing, a little, that he was here.
He always was the adult of our group, and we could have used a grown-up yesterday. The results of the scan came back clear, and the doctors told us that all they and we could do was wait. It was likely, they said, that Lizzie would make a full recovery, but there was a chance she would remain in an unconscious state, a coma. The baby, they went on, appeared unharmed, but at such an early stage it was impossible to be sure. If Lizzie did remain in a coma, it was possible for the baby to grow normally and be delivered by cesarean section. It was all too much to take in. After a few hours in A&E, Lizzie was transferred to intensive care, where only Jack and her parents were able to be with her. Kat and I ate a miserable meal in the hospital canteen before bunking down in the back of the Land Rover for the night. The word coma kept me awake into the small hours, with Kat tossing and turning beside me. Once we've unraveled our stiff bodies from the back of the Defender, and I've asked Simon to let Sir Hugo know I won't be in, we freshen up in the hospital toilets, then head up to ICU. With Lizzie's parents catching up on some sleep, we are allowed in to be with Jack, who was sitting attentively by Lizzie's bedside, holding her hand.
"How is she?" I ask.
"A little better. She came round earlier. They think she's almost out of the woods."
"Thank God,"
I say, slumping into one of the chairs on the opposite side of the bed, Kat taking the one next to me.
"And the baby?"
"They think it's fine."
I close my eyes for a moment, relief washing over me, saying a silent prayer.
"Are you any closer to knowing what happened?"
He shakes his head.
"We probably won't ever know. Most likely some idiot mucking around backstage. The doctors think her size and being pregnant made the effects much worse. She's just been unlucky."
"Have you guys made up?"
"Yes," he says slowly. "She came over in the morning. She seemed fine, and we were fine too. I was over the initial shock of the pregnancy. We hadn't figured things out, but we knew we would, and then..."
Jack tears off, the memory of finding her too raw to talk about.
"What matters is that she's doing so much better," says Kat.
Jack's eyes fill with tears, his hand shaking over Lizzie's.
You look exhausted, I say. Why don't you take the keys to the Land Rover and grab a few hours, Kip? It'll do you the world of good.
Hesitantly, Jack accepts the offer, leaving just Kat and me with Lizzie. Within only a few minutes of him leaving, Lizzie mutters something in her sleep.
Lizzie, what is it?
I ask.
Whimsy and white, she whispers.
What about it? I ask, laughing at her saying such a peculiar thing when she's still recovering. She opens her eyes a peep and offers a crazy smile.
Call them.
I take her hand in mine. Liz, it's really not important right now. Save your energy for getting fully better.
Live life now, she says, squeezing my hand.
A smile forms on her lips, and as she tries to sit up, one of the nurses rushes over.
Hi, Lizzie, how are you?
She asks, supporting her decision to sit.
In need of pancakes,
Lizzie says, weakly, and Kat and I laugh, and then we cry, because both of us know that pancakes means Lizzie is well and truly out of the woods.
I'm not sure we have those, says the nurse, but maybe when you're back on the ward, which won't be long now.
Thank God, I say, once the nurse has gone. It feels as if I've been walking around since yesterday with an elephant on my chest. Lizzie, you can't know how much you scared us.
Did I?
She says, completely oblivious to what she and we have just been through.
Yes,
says Kat, who's messaged Jack with an update and got Hannah on FaceTime.
Look who's back in the land of the living,
she says, showing Hannah Lizzie sitting up in bed.
Oh my God,
squeals Hannah. Hannah never squeals.
You can't know what a weight off my mind that is.
Do you feel like a rhino's been sitting on your head these last 24 hours? I ask.
Like you wouldn't believe, she says, her elbows resting on her desk, her hands pushing back her hair. My God, Liz, you properly scared me.
Enough for you to make me pancakes?
Wow, I say, amazed at the intensity of her craving. That baby in there must be really hungry. Lizzie's brow crinkles in confusion.
Jack had to tell the doctor you were pregnant, and we heard, I explain, worried she might be upset that we found out before she was able to tell us. Oh yeah, she says, slowly, clearly still enjoying the effects of the medication. I'd completely forgotten about that.
You're going to be a mummy, cries Hannah down the phone, and we couldn't be happier for you.
Not at all, I say, pressing my cheek against Lizzie's, and Kat does the same on the other side, so that the three of us are all facing Hannah on the screen.
Hashtag three weddings and a baby,
I cheer, and Hannah and Kat do the same.
I'm still gunning for four weddings,
says Liz, ever the optimist, even after what she's just been through. I'm just about to question who's to be wedding number four when another visitor arrives, someone it takes me a moment to place.
Dave,
says Lizzie drowsily, drifting back to sleep. I'm surprised at how different he looks out of wedding clothes.
How is she?
She's going to be okay, I say, getting up to greet him. His shoulders drop by about a foot.
Thank God. I saw Jack on his way out. Poor bloke looked knackered.
That's an understatement. It's good of you to come.
I don't live far away. When I heard, I wanted to be here for Jack's sake. How is she?
Doing much better, but in need of pancakes. He laughs lightly, understanding.
I'll go get some. It's the least I can do to help.
There's something in Dave's compassion for his cousin, and in his desire to help, that makes me wonder if I got him wrong at Lizzie's wedding. And a flicker of a thought occurs to me of something I might do for him. I leave Kat sleeping with Lizzie and head downstairs for a coffee. Lizzie's words, live life now, seemingly on loop in my head. They remind me that every part of my life needs some adjustment. A flatmate at home, a plan about work, and an emotional checkup about the men in my life. And then, accepting my drink, I'm hit with a desire to heed Lizzie's advice. Sitting at a wobbly table,
I scroll through my phone to Jessica, and without a second thought, I call her. "Hi, Jessica," I say when she answers.
"Hi, Bea. How are you?"
"I'm sorry it's taken me a while to get in touch. Are you still looking for a place to live?"
"I am."
"Would you like to take the room?"
"I'd love to. I was hoping you'd call.
Yours was the only place I've seen that felt like home." "That's so nice to hear," I say, thankful that I called her, feeling the decision that I've been procrastinating over since she viewed the flat is the right one. "You can move in any time. I'll partition off the living room as you suggested. Just let me know when suits."
"I will. Thanks, Bea.
You've made my day." The next call feels harder, and it takes me a moment to locate a number that might work. In the end, I find the switchboard for Whimsy and White's head office.
"How may I direct your call?"
asks the receptionist. "Hilary Bentham, please," I say, hoping she doesn't detect the tremor of fear in my voice.
"Please hold."
My heart leaps as I'm transferred away from reception and onto another line, which is answered remarkably quickly. "Hilary Bentham's office, Abigail speaking."
"Good morning,"
I stammer, doing my very best to sound composed. "My name is Bea Henshaw."
"Oh, hi, Bea."
Abigail immediately switches from formal to friendly. "Hilary asked me to call you today. Actually, you were next on my list."
"That's wonderful,"
I say, relaxing a little. "She'd like to set up a meeting as soon as possible. How are you placed for Wednesday?"
"I can do that.
Shall we say 2 o'clock? It feels as if I've run a marathon by the time we've finished the conversation, so instead of dashing straight back upstairs, I sit for a time, relieved to have things in order but unable to shake a niggling sensation that I'm tying myself down or overcommitting myself. As I'm trying to pin down the feeling, a voice says from above me, "Hi, Bea. I thought I'd find you here." I look up to find Simon standing protectively beside me.
"Simon! Hi!"
I say, bewildered at his sudden appearance. I kiss him on both cheeks. "How's Lizzie?"
"Getting stronger."
"And you?" he asks, his eyes tender. "I'm getting stronger, too. How are you?" He inclines his head to one side. "If I'm honest, I've been better."
"How so?"
I ask, indicating that he pull up a seat. "Edith ended our relationship." He runs his hands anxiously through his hair.
"She what?"
I ask, completely taken aback.
"Why?"
"That's an excellent question." He laughs awkwardly, the way he used to, when he wasn't telling me something, usually to protect me. I reach out a hand to him.
"Are you okay?"
"Not really." His eyes are full of remorse and searching mine for an answer. "I'm in a bit of a knot, as it happens."
"I'm so sorry, Si. First me, then Edith. You don't deserve that."
"No, I don't believe so," he says, managing a humorless laugh. "Still, life goes on."
"Yes," I reply,
Lizzie's advice of live life now still ringing in my ears. Chapter 26. No offence to Kat, but it's much more comfortable driving back to London in Simon's plush new Volvo than it would be in her Defender.
"Thanks for sticking around these last couple of days,"
I say as we cruise along the M4.
"And for the hotel room for Kat and me. There's nothing quite like spending a night in the back of a Land Rover to make you appreciate a comfy bed."
"It's the least I could do. I'm just glad Lizzie's on the mend."
"Me too.
She should be home tomorrow, and everything will be back to normal." I pause, realizing for the first time how much things have changed. "Well, other than the fact she's pregnant." "I'm pleased for the two of them," he says, casting me a sideways glance. "I can't wait to start my own family." The scene from Four Weddings with Charles and Tom flashes back into my mind, and it occurs to me that Simon is a bit like Tom in his total confidence that he'll find the right girl and get married. "You don't ever worry that you won't find the right person." He's watching the road,
but still I catch a quizzical look flash across his face.
What is it?
I ask.
It's just...